A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's asking about the history of monogamy, whether humans are actually naturally monogamous, or if that's just a story we tell ourselves, and what the evidence actually shows. He's also pointing to a tension he sees. Some forms of non-monogamy, like religious polygamy, get criminalized hard, while modern polyamory seems to fly under the radar. Is there a hypocrisy there? And then the third piece. He wants us to trace how the major religious traditions and governments have shaped this conversation over centuries, alongside what the science says about our actual predilections.
There really is. And I think the place to start is that opening assumption that humans are naturally monogamous, because if you ask most people, that's what they'd say. It's in the air we breathe. But the science tells a much messier story.
Because I've seen the pop science version, we're somewhere between monogamous and polygamous, we're mildly polygynous, men want to spread seed, women want security. That whole Evo Site Greatest Hits album.
But before we get there, let's start with the biological question, because that's where most people get the story wrong. When biologists look at a species and try to determine its mating system, they look at a few things. One is sexual dimorphism, how different males and females look in body size. And the popular version of that story goes something like, pair bonding is what makes us human. It's been selected for over millions of years, and deviations from it are pathological or primitive. And the actual evidence is way messier and way more interesting. It suggests a history of moderate male-male competition. Not harem level, but not pair-bonded purity either.
We're the slightly larger male primates. That's the big reveal?
Humans are what researchers call socially monogamous, but not sexually monogamous. And that's not a fringe position, that's the mainstream. In species where females mate with multiple males in quick succession, males evolve larger testes to produce more sperm and outcompete rivals. Chimpanzees have enormous testes. Gorillas, where one male monopolizes a harem, have tiny ones. And the evidence for this is cross-cultural and deep. One of the key data points comes from studies of human testis size relative to body size.
Our testicles are telling us we weren't strictly monogamous.
Gorillas, where a single male monopolizes a harem, have tiny testes. Humans fall right in the middle, larger than gorillas, smaller than chimps, which suggests an evolutionary history of moderate sperm competition. Human females don't advertise when they're ovulating. In many primates, there are visible swellings, behavioral changes. Humans conceal ovulation almost entirely.
Which would mean what, exactly? That males couldn't guard fertile windows effectively.
If you're trying to enforce strict monogamy, concealed ovulation makes that extremely difficult. You'd have to guard constantly. Then there's the ethnographic record. The standard estimate is that about 85% of pre-industrial societies permitted some form of polygyny, one man, multiple wives. That doesn't mean most men had multiple wives. In most of those societies, it was a minority of high-status men. But the point is, strict social monogamy as a universally enforced norm is the exception in human history, not the rule.
The natural monogamy story isn't even true at the social level for most of human history.
And then there's the genetic evidence. When researchers look at the ratio of variation in Y chromosomes versus mitochondrial DNA in different human populations, they can estimate the effective breeding ratio, how many men versus how many women were passing on genes in a given era. And the numbers suggest that throughout much of human history, more women than men reproduced, which is consistent with some degree of polygyny or differential male reproductive success.
Polygyny was common as a permission structure, but monogamy was common as a practice.
And the flip side, polyandry, one woman with multiple husbands, is rare but not non-existent. And here's where it gets nuanced. None of this means monogamy is unnatural, or that humans can't do it. We do all kinds of things that aren't our evolutionary default. We cook our food, we wear clothes, we use contraception.
Which brings up something I think gets lost in these debates. When people say humans aren't naturally monogamous, the assumption is that the alternative is some kind of sexual utopia or dystopia. Which brings us to the history piece.
Because monogamy as a legally enforced, socially mandatory institution is relatively recent, and it didn't emerge everywhere at once. The big shift happened in the West, and it was driven by a very specific confluence of factors. Because you have traditional polygamy, which is heavily regulated, often religiously codified, with clear rules about inheritance, lineage, obligations. In the ancient world, monogamy was not the default. In Mesopotamia, Assyrian law codes permitted men to take concubines. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs had multiple wives and consorts.
Yet one faces criminal sanction and the other doesn't. Let's trace that. Where does the legal hostility to polygamy actually come from?
The first century historian Josephus wrote that it was ancestral custom for Jews to have multiple wives simultaneously. But if you look at the history of anti-polygamy laws in the United States, the story gets uncomfortable fast. This is the pivot point. Early Christianity, drawing partly on Greco-Roman philosophical ideals and partly on its own theological commitments, begins to elevate monogamy as the only legitimate form of marriage. Paul's letters assume monogamy as the norm for church leaders. By the time of Augustine in the 4th and 5th centuries, you get a full-throated theological argument that monogamy is not just preferable, but divinely mandated, rooted in the creation narrative, one Adam, one Eve.
Augustine wasn't exactly writing from a position of personal sexual serenity.
No, and that matters. Augustine's own struggles with desire shaped his theology in ways scholars still debate. But the outcome was that Western Christianity became the primary vehicle for enforcing monogamy as a moral and eventually legal norm across Europe.
Meanwhile, polyamory, three consenting adults in a relationship, no religious framework, no formal marriage, faces essentially zero legal consequences anywhere. You can't marry multiple people, but you can live with and love multiple people with no legal barrier whatsoever.
Here's where the hypocrisy gets sharp. The state will prosecute a fundamentalist Mormon family for polygamy, even if all parties are consenting adults, but has absolutely nothing to say about a secular triad in Brooklyn. They were not. And the church's motivation wasn't purely theological.
It's the ick factor, dressed up in legal language. Polygamy reads as patriarchal, pre-modern, religiously alien. Polyamory reads as hip, negotiated, Western, individualist. The law is policing aesthetics, not harm.
We can see this in the way the Legal Academy has treated it. There's been a wave of scholarship arguing for legal recognition of polyamorous families, multiple parent adoption, hospital visitation rights, inheritance frameworks. These are serious discussions in law reviews. But polygamy gets almost no sympathetic legal scholarship, despite involving many of the exact same questions about consent, autonomy, and family structure.
The groups that normalize it at the institutional level face hostile laws. The groups that practice it as a lifestyle choice face shrugs. That's the asymmetry the prompt is pointing at.
It's worth asking why. I think part of it is that polygamy challenges the state's monopoly on defining the family. A religious community that builds its entire social structure around plural marriage is making a competing claim about what a family is. Polyamory, by contrast, doesn't challenge the legal institution of marriage, it just ignores it. You can have your three partners and still file taxes as a single person. The state can look the other way.
It's the difference between secession and truancy. One is a threat to the system, the other is just not showing up.
And this is where the history of major religious traditions gets really illuminating. Because the three Abrahamic faiths have had wildly different relationships with polygamy over time, and those relationships have shifted for reasons that are more political than theological.
Let's go tradition by tradition.
Judaism has a fascinating arc. In the Hebrew Bible, polygyny is unremarkable. Abraham has Sarah and Hagar. Jacob has Leah and Rachel and their handmaids. David and Solomon have multiple wives and concubines. There's no prohibition. The practice continued into the rabbinic period. It wasn't until around the year 1000 that Rabbi Gershom ben Judah issued a ban on polygyny, a takanah, a rabbinic decree that applied to Ashkenazi Jews. Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews never accepted the ban in the same way, and polygyny persisted in some Jewish communities in Yemen and North Africa well into the 20th century.
The ban was geographically limited? Ashkenazi Jews in Europe, but not Jews in the Islamic world.
and the reason matters. Gershom's ban was partly a response to Christian pressure. Jews living in Christian Europe were being denounced for the practice, and it was creating persecution. It was also partly internal, concerns about husbands taking second wives without the first wife's consent. But the key point is that it was a practical decree, not a claim that polygyny was inherently immoral. It was, this is causing problems, stop doing it.
Which is very different from God commands monogamy.
The LDS Church eventually renounced polygamy in 1890 as a condition of Utah's statehood. There are cases every year. The state mostly looks the other way unless there's a complaint. That's exactly what happened, and it wasn't subtle. Federal marshals were arresting people, families were torn apart, children were left without fathers who had gone into hiding. It was a full-scale legal assault on a religious minority. The shift comes through Paul and the early church fathers, who elevate celibacy as the highest ideal and monogamous marriage as a concession to human weakness. There are, though they're relatively rare. Most prosecutions in the U-Now target fundamentalist Mormon splinter groups, like the FLDS, and they often couple polygamy charges with other offenses. Underage marriage, fraud, welfare abuse.
It's not that polygamy is condemned, it's that marriage itself is sort of grudgingly tolerated, and polygamy would be too much of a good thing.
The court upheld the ban, citing harms to women and children in polygamous communities. But the real hardening came later, when the church became a political institution. And this is the hypocrisy the prompt is asking about. If you're in a polyamorous triad in Brooklyn, nobody is prosecuting you. You're not getting arrested. You might even write a New York Times Modern Love column about it.
Then there are the splinter groups that went the other way. The Anabaptists at Munster in the 1530s instituted polygamy, though that was under siege conditions and the whole thing collapsed in bloodshed. And, of course, the Mormons.
The legal distinction is ostensibly about marriage. Polygamy involves multiple marriage licenses or attempted plural marriage, whereas polyamory doesn't typically seek legal recognition. But that's a formal distinction, not a substantive one. In both cases, you have multiple concurrent intimate partnerships. In both cases, there are often shared households and shared child rearing. The difference is that one group is culturally stigmatized and religiously marginal, and the other is culturally progressive and increasingly mainstream.
It's less about the structure of the relationships, and more about whose ox is being gored.
That's a bracingly direct way to put it, but yes. The legal system targets religious polygyny because it's associated with patriarchal control, underage marriage, and insular communities that resist state oversight. Polyamory, by contrast, is framed as egalitarian, consensual, and individualistic, all values that align with modern liberal norms. Whether those framings are always accurate is a separate question, but the differential treatment is stark. The Quran, Surah An-Nisa, verse 3, says a man may marry up to 4 women, but only if he can treat them all equally. And the racial dimension is also inescapable. Polygamy prosecutions in the West disproportionately target religious minorities, Mormons historically, and in Europe and Canada, Muslim immigrants.
It's a permission slip with a built-in self-destruct clause.
In the UK, polygamous marriages contracted abroad can be recognized for certain benefits purposes, which creates its own legal tangle, but the practice is officially prohibited. In Turkey and Tunisia, it's banned entirely. Tunisia's ban dates back to 1956, and it was justified on exactly that Quranic reasoning about the impossibility of equal treatment. I think that's fair. And I want to be careful here because I'm not advocating for criminalizing polyamory. I'm pointing out the inconsistency.
The legal landscape globally?
If it doesn't, then maybe the rationale is pretextual, and the real driver is cultural animus towards specific religious communities. And the trend line is toward restriction. Many countries that permitted it have tightened laws over the past century.
Here's the thing that strikes me. In all three traditions, the conversation is almost exclusively about polygyny. One man, multiple women. Polyandry barely registers. Even the word polygamy is used as a synonym for polygyny. The asymmetry is baked into the language.
Justice Scalia warned about exactly this in his Lawrence dissent. He said the logic of that decision would inevitably lead to the invalidation of laws against bigamy and polygamy. So far, courts haven't gone there, but the legal foundation is eroding.
That connects to the third piece of the prompt, what the major religious traditions have actually said about this. We touched on Christianity, but let's broaden the frame.
So let's do a quick survey. Judaism, polygyny, was practiced in the biblical period and into the early Common Era.
Let's pull on the inheritance thread, because that's where the state's interest in marriage actually comes from. Marriage isn't just about love or companionship. It's a property regime.
That ban was time-limited and geographic. It applied to European Jews, not to Jews in Islamic lands, where polygyny remained permissible under Jewish law into the 20th century. Yemeni Jews practiced polygyny until they immigrated to Israel, where it was banned by civil law.
That's the phrase. A polygamous household with 4 wives and 20 children is a bureaucratic nightmare. Who's the next of kin? Who makes medical decisions? Who inherits the house?
Classical Islamic jurisprudence has debated what equal treatment means, but the permission is clear and has been practiced throughout Islamic history. Today, polygamy is legal in many Muslim-majority countries, including Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, and parts of Nigeria and Indonesia.
Which is why you're seeing the push for legal recognition. But that push is coming from secular polyamorists, not religious polygamists. And the reception is different.
It's different because the aesthetics are different. A polyamorous triad in Portland reads as progressive. A polygamous Mormon family in Utah reads as reactionary. The behavior is structurally similar, but the cultural coding is opposite.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability versus, what's the polygamy equivalent? The banjo of rural suspicion.
Polygyny was common in pre-modern Tibet, Bhutan, and parts of Southeast Asia.
We've got a legal system that punishes religious non-monogamy and ignores secular non-monogamy. And we've got 3 major religious traditions that all converged on monogamy for reasons that are more political and practical than theological. Polyandry is the really rare form, right?
It's the rarest form of polygamy cross-culturally. George Murdoch's Ethnographic Atlas, which coded over 1,000 societies, found that about 85% permitted polygyny, less than 1% practiced polyandry. The classic cases are in Tibet, Nepal, and parts of the Himalayas, where fraternal polyandry, brothers sharing a wife, kept family land from being fragmented across generations.
The human mating repertoire is genuinely diverse, and different environments select for different forms.
And that's the key evolutionary insight. There's no single human mating system. We're ecologically flexible. Depending on resource distribution, pathogen prevalence, male wealth inequality, and a dozen other variables, different societies converge on different norms. Monogamy tends to emerge where resource distribution is relatively egalitarian and where paternal investment is critical for offspring survival.
Monogamy isn't about love or morality. It's about males not murdering each other's babies.
That's the unromantic version. There's a competing theory, the pair bonding as provisioning model, where monogamy emerges because human infants are so helpless and require so much investment that 2 parents are better than 1. This is where the data gets really interesting and also fraught.
We do see that in some societies, the Mosul people in China, for example, they practice what anthropologists call walking marriage, where women live with their natal families, men visit at night, and children are raised by the mother's family. There's no expectation of sexual exclusivity, and paternity is basically irrelevant.
They might be caused by the social and legal infrastructure that supports monogamous marriage. Tax benefits, inheritance rights, social recognition, all of which historically haven't been extended to other relationship forms. The nuclear family isn't a human universal.
Which brings us back to the core question. If monogamy isn't biologically hardwired, if it's not theologically mandated in any clear way, if it emerged for practical and political reasons, why do we treat it as the only legitimate option?
In societies where polygyny is institutionalized and normalized, some studies find that first wives often have higher status and more household help, but co-wife conflict and jealousy are well documented. The bigger concern is the demographic effect. Polygyny, when practiced at scale, creates a surplus of unmarried young men, which is a well-established predictor of social instability, violence, and conflict.
The second layer?
The second is that monogamy does solve real coordination problems. It simplifies inheritance, it reduces male-male competition, it creates clear household units that the state can tax and regulate. From the state's perspective, monogamy is just easier to administer.
It's not that monogamy is morally superior. It's that monogamy is administratively convenient.
It's the stability argument, and it's been made explicitly by political theorists. Montesquieu wrote about it. Adam Smith noted it.
That's a pretty jaundiced view of the whole enterprise.
I'm a retired pediatrician. I've seen too many families to be romantic about institutions. But I'm not saying monogamy is bad. For many people, it works beautifully. In a sense, yes. By closing off the possibility of accumulating multiple wives, normative monogamy forced high-status men to invest in a single family rather than building harems. It lowered the stakes of mate competition.
That pretense has real consequences. The prompt mentions religious groups facing hostile laws. We're not talking about abstract debates. We're talking about families being prosecuted, children being taken from parents, communities being driven underground.
The Short Creek Raid in 1953 is the starkest American example. Arizona State Police raided a fundamentalist Mormon community, arrested hundreds of people, and took over 200 children into state custody. And it's not uncontroversial. Critics point out that you can have monogamy without gender equality. Just look at most of European history, and that the causal arrow might run the other direction.
The justification was protecting women and children, but the intervention itself caused enormous trauma.
Which is the recurring pattern. The state claims to be protecting the vulnerable, but the enforcement mechanism is often more harmful than the practice it's targeting. And that's where the hypocrisy really bites, because if the concern were about coercion and exploitation, we'd see similar scrutiny of monogamous marriages where those things happen. But we don't.
Because monogamous marriage is the default. Coercion within monogamy is just a bad marriage. Coercion within polygamy is a crime.
In most Western countries, you can have multiple sequential spouses, serial monogamy, and nobody calls it polygamy, even though functionally, over a lifetime, you're accumulating multiple partners and often multiple sets of children.
Let me ask you something that's been in the back of my mind through all of this. If the science says we're flexible, and the history shows monogamy is a practical arrangement that got moralized after the fact, and the legal system is hypocritical in how it treats different forms of non-monogamy, what's the actual argument for keeping things as they are? Try to formalize it with a marriage certificate, and suddenly it's a crime.
And that tells you something about what marriage law is actually protecting. It's not protecting children. Polyamorous households have children, and we don't prosecute the parents. It's not protecting women from exploitation. We don't investigate whether a polyamorous arrangement is coercive unless there's a criminal complaint. What marriage law is protecting is a specific institutional form, the dyadic, state-recognized, legally privileged union.
Which is fine, but then let's be honest about what we're doing.
Let's not pretend this is about preventing harm when we only prevent it selectively. If the concern is about consent and exploitation, then regulate consent and exploitation across all relationship forms. If the concern is about child welfare, regulate child welfare. But targeting religious polygyny while giving a cultural pass to secular multi-partner arrangements is just selective enforcement dressed up as principle. It's not that monogamy is morally superior, it's that it produces more stable societies.
Monogamy as a kind of resource equalization mechanism. Spread the reproductive opportunity around.
The argument goes, if consenting adults have a fundamental right to structure their intimate relationships as they see fit, and if the state can't justify restricting that right except by a compelling interest that's narrowly tailored, then blanket bans on multi-partner marriage are overbroad. In monogamous societies, the marriage market is tighter, and men marry closer to their own age. It creates different social dynamics.
That's a consequentialist argument, not a moral one. And it only applies to polygyny, not to other forms of non-monogamy. If you've got a closed triad of three people, or a polyamorous network where everyone has multiple partners, you're not creating a surplus male problem.
Polyamorous would argue that their relationships are egalitarian and consensual, and that the harms associated with religious polygyny are about patriarchy and insularity, not about the number of partners. The low levels of polygyny we see in most societies where it's permitted don't produce those effects.
We're back to the hypocrisy. The legal system isn't making these distinctions. It's just painting all non-monogamy with the same brush, unless it's secular, in which case it's invisible.
It might not happen soon. The political valence is terrible for polygamy, and nobody wants to be the judge who legalized it. But the doctrinal logic is there, and it's building. And the answer, as far as I can tell, is that the law is downstream of cultural aesthetics, not principle.
The law is downstream of the ick factor.
We're a pair-bonding species with a strong tendency towards social monogamy, but also a long evolutionary history of extra-pair mating and, in many societies, institutionalized polygyny. Monogamy as a legally enforced universal norm is a cultural product, not a biological imperative.
Because having the conversation means admitting that the emperor has no clothes, that the legal preference for monogamy isn't grounded in anything more solid than this feels normal to us.
This feels normal to us is a terrible basis for criminal law.
Let's talk about the modern landscape for a moment. Because polyamory and consensual non-monogamy are having a cultural moment. There's survey data on this.
The question is, which arrangements produce flourishing and for whom, and under what conditions? And that's an empirical question that we've barely begun to investigate honestly because the cultural stakes are so high. A 2017 study estimated that 4-5% of Americans are currently in a consensually non-monogamous relationship. That's not a tiny fringe, it's millions of people. And I understand that anxiety, but I think it's misplaced. Understanding that monogamy is a cultural achievement, not a biological default, actually makes it more impressive, not less. It's a set of practices and norms that humans built over centuries to solve specific social problems. And like any human institution, it can be evaluated, reformed, and adapted. That's not a threat. That's just taking it seriously.
The hypocrisy question. The differential treatment of polygamy and polyamory seems to me like a natural consequence of a legal system that's trying to protect a norm without being honest about what it's doing.
We want the benefits of normative monogamy, stability, reduced male violence, paternal investment, without the discomfort of admitting that we're enforcing a cultural preference through law. And the law has nothing to say about it.
Because it doesn't threaten the institution of marriage. These people aren't asking the state to recognize their triads as marriages. They're just living their lives.
That's the ultimate dodge. The state can tolerate non-monogamy as long as it doesn't ask for recognition. The moment you want hospital visitation rights or inheritance protections, you're making a claim the system isn't built to handle.
Which is where the religious groups actually have a stronger claim, in a way. They're not just asking for tolerance, they're asking for recognition. They're saying this is our family structure. It's institutionally codified. It's been practiced for generations, treated as legitimate.
The state says no, precisely because it's institutional. Because recognizing religious polygamy would mean acknowledging an alternative family structure that challenges the state's monopoly on defining marriage. Secular polyamory doesn't challenge that monopoly because it doesn't ask for anything.
The hostility is proportional to the threat. Polyamory is invisible, gets no hostility. Religious polygamy is institutional, gets crushed.
The people caught in the middle are the ones who suffer. The fundamentalist Mormon families who aren't coercing anyone, who are just trying to live according to their beliefs. The Muslim families in countries where polygyny is legal, but who face social stigma and bureaucratic barriers. The polyamorous families who can't visit their partner in the hospital because they're not legally family.
It's a mess, and I don't think there's a clean solution. But the first step is just being honest about what's actually driving the policy, and it's not principle.
It's almost never principle. It's history, aesthetics, and administrative convenience wearing a moral mask. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Naked mole rats have translucent skin on their undersides, which allows the light from bioluminescent fungi in their tunnels to cast a faint, ghostly glow through their tissues. A property that medieval chroniclers in the early period described as the walking lantern of the earth, though no such creature was ever confirmed in Belize.
The walking lantern of the earth. That's a D&D monster waiting to happen.
I have so many questions about medieval chroniclers and naked mole rats, and I'm going to suppress all of them.
All right. So where does this leave us? I think the prompt forces a reckoning that most people don't want to have. The science says humans are flexible, not hardwired for monogamy. The history shows that monogamy became dominant for practical and political reasons, not moral ones. And the legal system enforces it selectively, targeting religious non-monogamy while ignoring secular non-monogamy. The whole thing is a patchwork of unexamined assumptions.
I think the most honest thing we can say is that there's no single human mating system. We're a species that adapts our relationship structures to our environment, our economy, our ecology. Monogamy works well in some contexts. Other arrangements work well in others. The impulse to declare one correct and the others deviant is a political impulse, not a scientific one.
The question going forward is whether the legal system will ever catch up to that reality, or whether we'll just keep pretending that the current arrangement is natural and just, because it's easier than having the conversation.
My guess is that change will come from the secular side first. Polyamorous families are already pushing for legal recognition in areas like domestic partnership ordinances, and those battles are happening at the municipal level. The religious cases are harder because the cultural coding is so loaded. But if the principle is consent and harm reduction, the distinction between religious and secular non-monogamy becomes harder and harder to defend.
That's the open question. Whether we can build a legal framework that actually evaluates relationships based on consent and welfare, rather than on whether they look like what we're used to. I'm not holding my breath, but I think the conversation is worth having.
It's definitely worth having, and I'm glad the prompt pushed us to have it.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running, and for whatever dark corner of the internet he pulled that naked mole rat fact from. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find more episodes at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.